On this week's Bet the Process podcast, Rufus and I are reunited, and it feels okay. We talk a little bit about how to model things with incomplete data, and then we kind of go down a rat hole of how he finds edge in those situations. We talk a little bit about the weather, literally the weather. And we finally have Jordan Majewski on to talk about the final four matchups because he did such a great job last week telling us what was going to happen in the Sweet 16. And with that, let's start the process.
Bet the process. Bet the process. Welcome to the podcast. Bet the process. It's not the typical cookie cutter nonsense. If you came just for picks, you're in the wrong place. Find a tout with the narrative to make a strong case. Instead of blindly assuming a team must be tanking, we're looking for the edge of massive Peabody rankings. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic.
Welcome to another episode of Bet the Process podcast, where Rufus and I are reunited, and it feels so good. Rufus, how was the week of golf in Alabama with Tom?
It was great. I actually listened to Bet the Process last week too, which is a rarity for me. But I listened cover to cover the entire thing, and I thought Drew did a fantastic job. Jordan was great. You know, maybe it didn't seem like you guys missed me at all. Maybe I should just let Drew fill in every week.
Well, I think that was what was interesting, and I know you're somewhat kidding, but like Rufus literally does not listen to the podcast when he's on it. So when I'm like, hey, have you ever thought about what you could be better at? You're like, I don't know. I've never listened to the podcast. If we go back to the Drew episode, I mean, sorry, Drew's more to the Jordan piece of it. I thought he did such a good job in breaking down the games, and much of what he said came to fruition, right? The idea that Illinois was a tough matchup for Iowa State because they could play five out. And a lot of what Iowa State, you know, did, and Drew kind of force fit his narrative around being able to, for Iowa State to be able to get more possessions as a reason to sort of blindly bet the second half. And he did, I think, do that because it was a situation that he was excited about, i.e. Iowa State was down by 10. I think they were -3 in the second half. He actually ended up winning that also. We talked a little bit about the UConn San Diego State total, which I know that you were on the over on, and Drew actually liked the under, which was the, and I don't, you know, again, like we think the world of Drew. So, but he had that lazy handicap of these two teams played last year in the finals. The total was like 131.5. It's now 135.5, and, you know, went upwards to like 137, I think, at game time. But it's interesting because like his thought was, hey, UConn's been playing slower. These two teams are playing now. The difference is like, this is an under, and the game's like started way over and then just slowed down where, you know, San Diego State could not score at all and ended up going under. Did you have any like interesting tidbits that you found?
I watched a lot of those games actually. And I remember being like, oh, we're in great shape on that over. And it didn't come to fruition, but there was another one I think we were opposite on. I think that was it, the Tennessee game. Creighton, Tennessee, we were over there, and I think Drew liked the under.
Yeah, I don't remember what
thought was going to win by a lot, and then it ended up, I mean, because I had a bigger route on Tennessee there due to Calcutta stuff, and it ended up, you know, I ended up kind of forgetting that I was actually supposed to be rooting for the over, and it did come in at the end with fouling in the last minute.
That was actually one of those games where it looked like if Creighton had missed one more shot, that it was going to go under for sure. You know what I mean? Like where they just going to give up at that point. And then it ended up going over by, I think, over 10 points or something like that. Like those like leverage situations in college basketball on totals are incredible sweats where they like it. And the difference in, and so like, actually someone asked that in the chat about whether we, you know, how do you model coaching behavior and that kind of thing? I'm not sure if that's something you feel comfortable talking about, go ahead.
Look, I mean, I think coding is largely trying to quantify common sense, and I should say trying to quantify reality, what actually happens, not common sense, because coaches don't always have common sense and players don't always have common sense. I mean, there've been games where I saw a team fell when down 11 with 20 seconds to go, right? And by the way, if you saw the end of that Duke NC State game, which I didn't because I turned it off after once I knew Duke had lost the game, there was something like there were 30 points in the last 4 minutes of the game. Duke just kept fouling despite the game being out of reach. And you do get to these sort of, there's these levered points where, you know, I would say the highest leverage situation if you're a total backer is going to be a game that's maybe like I'd say anywhere from like a 10 to 13 point game with like a minute and a half to go. And you could get a game with very, very few points there, or you could get a ton of points. And so, you know, if you're running simulations, I mean, what you want to do is basically figure out how often teams actually foul in certain situations and then kind of model that and simulate it out from there. And you have to assign some probabilities clearly. And I think you could account for coach behavior by looking at where a particular coach or team differs, if they are more likely to foul. And I would just throw out all situations where teams never foul or always foul, right? Like a team down three with 30 seconds to go, or let's say 25 seconds to go, is going to foul. They're going to foul or they're going to go for the steal. Like there's no situation where they just decide to let the other team run out the clock. So, but in situations where, you know, teams don't always foul, I mean, my personal way of approaching it would be kind of in a sort of Bayesian way where I'd fit these sort of coaching random effects or team random effects on that. But in terms of rooting, Jeff, I've always kind of wondered what that optimal situation is for an over. And I don't actually know it, but anecdotally, like to me, it feels like you want a team that's down like six with a minute to go, because they can, even if they miss a shot, whether they miss or make on their possession, they're probably still going to be fouling. You know, if a team is down nine, they go down, they miss a three-pointer, miss a layup, the other team gets it, makes two free throws. Like, I mean, you can quickly get to a situation where they won't foul. And if it's like, I mean, maybe seven's better, but because, you know, I guess a team down six, they make a three-pointer, you know, there's 40 seconds to go, suddenly they're down three. I mean, maybe they don't foul there.
I think this is unknowable. I don't think it's that.
I don't think it's unknowable.
I understand why it's knowable. I understand why you want to do it.
Oh, I think
it's kind of like
a fun
thing to think about.
Maybe we should have a bet on what it is, because we could literally go and break down time remaining. So we could say with a minute to go, who has the let's say we only did it for the trailing team having the ball, they're down X amount of points. How many points are scored from that point on? We could kind of look and see what situation is the best for scoring. I'd be curious. This is built into our betting stuff, but you know, I'm not live betting or anything. And you know, some people like sweating games, looking actually at the live odds to see what it is. I hate doing that. I kind of like for totals, I kind of just have this idea in my head of where it should be. You know, it's like, I kind of break it up into 5 minute time increments in my head. And so I kind of have this idea of like, okay, where am I likely to get more points? What situation, end of game situation, am I going to be rooting for? And maybe I'm off on that, but I think also watching and thinking about it that way kind of can help you learn as well, give you ideas.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. And when you talk about the effect of like individual teams or coaches in some of this stuff, because that's obviously small sample size issue, right? Like how much of an impact is it at a team level versus just having a generalized, you know, behavior in terms of what, like in the simulator?
So I don't think it's a big team level thing. I mean, I think that in general, I mean, I think there are coaches that are going to foul a little more, but I don't think it's necessarily this coach always does this either. I would guess some of it might depend on whether if the team was expected to win or not. Like, I think sometimes there's end of game frustration fouls, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's what's probably happening in that Duke game that you mentioned.
Yeah,
right?
Like,
they were
just like
to win,
God,
and they're just
it.
Frustrated.
Right. Yeah. But whereas a worse team that expects to lose probably is going to be more inclined to just throw in the towel. I don't know if there's home road splits there, but I mean, these are all things that I would look at.
Well,
but I think,
interesting,
again,
though,
this stuff isn't going to come. Like, these effects, I think, are still going to be relatively minor on the team level. And so you have to get yourself into that situation where it actually occurs, which isn't going to happen that often either, where you have these sort of situations where some teams would foul and some teams wouldn't. I think more often, clearly, you have situations where, okay, this is a situation where every team's going to foul, or this is a situation where no team is going to foul. And then the rest depends on if you make shots or not. Now, I think one thing that might be interesting to see is which teams, I think this might be better, Jeff, which teams, if they're down a bunch, or let's say down 5 to 10 points with 30 seconds to a minute to go, go down and just get quick layups every time versus try to shoot the three. Because you want those layups. The layups are going to, if you're an overbetter. Because they're almost guaranteed, because the defense is going to say, okay, we're not going to foul. And maybe that just comes down to having a point guard that can penetrate. And I think a lot of the low total games, you just get situations where, you know, it should be a situation where you get a lot of points in the final minute, but you don't, because the trailing team just can't make a shot and they can't even get a good shot attempt with, like, quickly. There's, you know, and it's like, well, maybe that's why this game was totaled at 130 to begin with.
So I think one of the things, I think that if you think about the David Au and the Ed Miller lesson, it's finding situations that are modeled generalized, where you feel like the model wouldn't be possible, and you have some insight and ability to basically, like, plug your own bias in there based on, you know, knowing a tendency that a coach has or a team has. And this idea of teams that go for the layup versus the three, or teams that start fouling early. I wonder if there is ways to do that. This is a sample size issue, because I just don't know if you're going to find enough sample sizes to be able to do this, but, like, coaching tendencies over the years and teams, like, I'm sure there are some edge cases that you could isolate and get yourself into a positive EV situation based on knowing those and betting them against a more generalized model.
I mean, the thing is, you don't really see live markets open late, though. So you'd have to sort of...
It'd be like 4 minutes left, something like that.
You'd have to look,
right?
At like with 5 minutes to go, right, and be like, okay, this looks like a situation where this could occur. And maybe the key there is, if there's some sort of alternate line or something like that, alternate total, I think that's where you could take advantage more. If there's a chance for one of these 30 points in the last 2 minutes situations.
Yeah.
Or a chance for, like, no scoring at the end.
Yeah,
I mean, I've seen games that are 6-point games where there's no scoring in the last 2 minutes, and it remains a 6-point game, which is kind of insane.
Do you have any thoughts on, like, the other thing that I think Jordan nailed last week was the Duke Houston game, where essentially he intimated that he thought Duke would win, and obviously Jamal Shedd being hurt,
right,
was a big piece of it, right? Yeah, and just generally, like, talent level and you know, ability to be strong with the ball, that kind of stuff. He had some good points on a lot of it. And again, Jamal Shedd getting hurt was a big deal, but you did watch that game not feeling like Houston should be the favorite in that game. Game progressed.
Did you watch the first 5 minutes of the game?
It was ugly.
I was like, man, Houston, it's like a college team playing against a high school JV team or something like that. It just felt like Houston was so much more physical and big, and Duke had no chance. And then they clawed their way back. They acclimated.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big concern, right? Whether Duke could handle the physicality of Houston.
Without, like, talking too much about, I mean, I'm not sure how much you're comfortable sharing on the college basketball stuff, but, like, Alabama is a team that you guys have, like, largely been on a lot this season. And I'm curious about how much of that comes to the idea that they, like, get pretty high quality shots, or do you have any idea why you have a bias towards Alabama?
Well, we like Tennessee as well, and at least this, you know, this tournament, and Tennessee seems to love the mid-range jumper. So I don't think it's just that, but Alabama, it's true. You look at their shot chart, it's three pointers and layups, and they're an offensive juggernaut. They play really fast. They've been bad on defense all year. You could ask,
defensively? Do you know during this run? I mean, like, again, they're one of those teams that's like,
yes,
you can't look, you what's that?
I mean, just from watching the games, like, I think you could clearly say yes.
But they're like one of those teams that you can't, like, look at the score and understand whether they're good at defense, because they play so fast and they create so many possessions. that it's hard to know if they're playing better defense. Obviously, like anecdotally, it seems like it. Maybe we'll ask. Right. We're gonna have Jordan back on this week because we want to hear his Final Four. Selfishly, we want to hear his Final Four analysis, and the best way to do it is invite him to come on the podcast.
Well, I think with defense though, there's the effort part of defense, which if you watch the NBA, which I don't, but I don't think it's always there on, you know, in a regular season game. And I don't think with Alabama all year they had the defensive buy-in, but I think now clearly it is. So there's the effort piece, and then there's the actual skill. Like, you're not going to just magically become 7 foot, however tall Plingin is for UConn, and a great shot blocker, right?
He's definitely tall. I mean, the idea of him
amazing quickness. Yeah. So,
okay. Do you want to talk about the unknowable tweet that you sent to me? I kind of like that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got some questions for the pod. Do you want to read the tweet, Jeff?
Yeah. Jeff Zimmerman said, how do you deal with information that you know is incomplete? With baseball, it could be someone playing through an injury, or if a player went to driveline during the offseason. Some is known, but not all. Maybe a data set is 50% complete, 25%, 1%. And that was from Jeff Zimmerman. The driveline thing, just as a call out, right? And I should have, like, largely when Kyle Bodie, you know, he's a pitching consultant for the Red Sox
the body
now.
Bodie.
And then when he got that job, I should have tweeted out the episode that we did with him. Because I think it was a good episode, and the driveline thing has me very excited, because Craig Breslow is Craig Breslow went to Yale, right? He's the new GM the Red Sox.
He pitched for the Red Sox. He pitched for the A's. He pitched for a bunch. He was a crafty lefty, wasn't he?
Yeah. You know, on the name drops situation, I did go to his wedding. So I was texting with him yesterday a little bit about their early season. So I'm excited. And Andrew Bailey, who was one of his teammates in Oakland, he also is now with the Red Sox. He's their pitching coach. So it's like, you know, you have this unified front, and with Kyle helping them out, I'm pretty excited about it. So anyways, go back to your question or your answer.
So, well, I think it's a great question. I think that it's kind of at the heart of what is challenging about sports handicapping, and no data set you ever get is complete. And I think it's a good thing though. If the data was all complete, then it's a lot harder to find an edge. And so I think part of the edge is being able to process incomplete information. And so I think you have to, there's different sorts of incomplete information, clearly. So there's the kind of inside information that you can get, like somebody messages me who knows is best friends with the caddy for some PGA Tour player, who said that their player is all over the place on the range and just has no feel for his game right now. That's harder, I think, because that's something like how much credence
that wasn't Corey Jazz who did that to you? No, just kidding. I don't want to get Corey.
But how much credence do you put in that information? Like, is there any credibility to it? I remember from my days with ESPN hearing from Michael Collins, who had caddied for, I think he caddied for 8 or 9 different players over his caddying career before he became a media person, saying that there was like almost no correlation between how a player was playing on the range that week, what they were doing in the range sessions, with how they actually played on the course, which was interesting. Cause he said, like, he was like, oh man, this week's going to be bad. And those were the weeks oftentimes when his player like did quite well. And so sometimes you just finding one thing during a round and suddenly they're back. So that type of information, like those one-offs, I think if it's someone's interpretation of how a guy's practicing or something like that, I put like no weight on that. But if it's an injury thing, that's where I will take a lot more note. So if I hear some guy's sick, or if there's any rumor about Jason Day's back, clearly, like, you got to worry about that. Jeff was looking down and not laughing at that, because Jason Day, I mean, I think he was the inspiration for me to like try to build something about like trying to predict withdrawal probabilities for golfers, because Jason Day withdrawing has certainly cost us money in matchups. But I think the other questions you need to ask though is like, okay, is this information public? Do other people have this information or using it? And or do other people have complete information? So with injuries, I think a big challenge is, and I think in the question, they talked about a guy who was playing through an injury. You know, I don't have all that in my data set. I can point to a time where, like, okay, Will Zalatoris is coming back from back surgery, or say Daniel Berger is coming back from an injury and clearly they're not themselves yet, or this particular player was playing through some injury and was playing really poorly. How much of that, I think oftentimes we blame the injury on something, but it could have been just that the player was also just kind of underachieving mostly, and the injury was a little bit a part of it. There's other things, like, I'm using golf as the example here, but I think a few years ago, Harris English, he'd been bad for a little while. Like, he was a good golfer in college, good PGA professional. He kind of went through the doldrums and kind of lost it for a little while. And then I think this was around 2000 or 2001. He started playing well again. And then you hear that, oh, he had a new swing coach, you know, a year before. And ever since then, his results have been better. And so how much of that is just a narrative we create after the fact to explain the improvement versus that that's what it was. And so to kind of put it into context of something going on now, I mean, JT and Bones, his caddy, just broke up. And, you know, if JT goes on some really good run, people will say, oh, well, it's because he had a new caddy or something like that. Or if he starts playing awful, maybe that's going to be given as a reason. Whereas in reality, I think that probably has very little to do with it. Another question asked actually about the effect of that on JT's putting in the Masters. And I would say, like, I don't think the caddy is doing that much there. I think clearly good caddies can have an impact, but I think so much of it is sort of the player to player thing. So I'm kind of getting away from that. But I mean, I do think the challenge is, if you have information on a particular player playing through an injury, you don't know if other players were playing through injuries. Clearly there are other players playing through injuries that you don't know about. Now, I think that if you're up against other people that are building quantitative models and aren't making tweaks due to things like that, you can have an advantage. It's a source of alpha. If you know that, you know, I should downgrade or deweight this player in this particular tournament because he was somehow different than he is now. He was doing something different. He was playing through an injury. He broke his driver and was playing with, you know, was not unable to use driver in this particular round or something like that. So I think those manual tweaks and adjustments, I guess, for predictive purposes do have value. And despite the fact that you aren't able to pinpoint those things for every golfer, when you can, or every team or player or whatever, when you do have that opportunity, I think it does add value. I know that was a sort of a long-winded answer, but
I think there's a little bit of, like, signal noise here, right? Which is ultimately, when you think about some of these narratives, okay, and so I'll give you my version of this, right? I was getting text messages about the, you know, Scotty's putting coach Phil Kenyon or whatever, and like how he'd kind of ruin Rory and all this kind of stuff. And like, it's like, oh, he's going to, and I, you know, I saw him working with Scheffler at the Genesis, and, you know, like Scotty's initial putting wasn't good. And he was struggling a little bit, but now he's like caught fire. So all of a sudden that narrative of,
well,
this guy messed him
fire?
Up.
He missed a 5-footer to force a playoff. He missed a bunch of putts coming down the stretch, but yes.
Okay, so
when you say
so
caught fire, like he's a worse putter this year than he was last year. But here's my question. Here's my question.
Then
we're quick to assume that, okay, we're quick to say, okay, Rory putted poorly because of this guy. Maybe this guy's particular method just didn't vibe with the way Rory liked to putt. And I would assume that.
Yeah, but you're even posing a much more interesting.
Worked with Rory, and that Rory probably did putt well during that time. I mean, I don't think that's.
But you're actually posing a much more interesting question, right? Which is, Scottie Scheffler right now going into the Masters will be the odds-on favorite.
Clearly,
the narrative around Scottie Scheffler. What's that? Right.
I said clearly. Yes, you're correct.
Yeah, the narrative around Scheffler is he's always been the best ball striker. Now the way he's putting, you know, I'm just telling you, right? And so, if your counterfactual to that narrative is that, you know what, like, his putting is not great. He just caught fire, and putting is one of the most variable skills, but totally correlated to winning. So is Scottie Scheffler overrated going into the Masters, Rufus Peabody, best number one golf better in the world? You tell me on the spot now. Overrated or underrated?
I say probably close to appropriately rated.
Okay.
I think the other thing to think about with putting is how much confidence plays a role, which is, and that's hard to quantify there. But because we know that there's short-term fluctuations in putting, and that sort of long-term putting form matters a lot more than sort of these short-term fluctuations. And so if I want to predict how Scheffler's going to putt, I'd rather look at a much longer time horizon than the last few weeks. Now, I do wonder how much that translates to the confidence piece matters, though, in terms of it affecting not just putting, but other areas of the game. I don't want to go too much deeper on that, but I feel like there are I think quantifying those sort of psychological impacts is kind of maybe the next frontier.
I mean, that's one of the places that you've been the most fascinated about with golf, right?
Always.
Is understanding the psychological impact, the ability of someone to close. And I know that, without I'll give away stuff, I know that does go into your model, right? You do have some level of understanding of like positioning, whereas it's probably less the case in a lot of other sports, right?
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, a guy like Tiger, we know he was such a good closer. His record with the lead in the final round is just so much better than what you see from normal golfers. And it's not that he necessarily like played better than his baseline skill level. It's just that he wasn't affected by pressure the same way other people were. At least, you could forecast him without factoring in the positional impact, the fact that, being in the lead guy, for anybody that's watched golf, I mean, I don't think it's a surprise that if you're sleeping on the lead, you don't tend to play as well. There's a real impact. And
so this is like a very interesting, I think, overall theme in this conversation that we've been having from the coaching tendencies and whatnot. I'm guessing your model does not take into account individual players' tendencies. It just looks at generalized.
I try to find ways to do that. What I would really love is to have like, if
but you don't put that, do you put that into your model and on an individual golfer level?
Yeah. Certain golfers are getting bumps in pressure situations, or not bumps, but like bumps relative to other golfers in pressure situations for sure.
Okay. And what gave you you just kept testing it enough to where you found that it was significant and it made sense.
I looked at different ways of trying to look at it, I guess is the question or the answer to that. But I mean, I'm not going to go into detail on that just because I don't want to keep leaking information.
We can have the seven listeners sign an NDA.
What would be really interesting though would be to, if you got information on sort of like golfers' heart rates and things like that, if you could get some of that wearable tech stuff, wearable medical stuff, like I think that would probably tell me a lot more, or I would be able to kind of figure out who's going to perform better under pressure a lot quicker from that. I think that would be a leading indicator.
Well, so that's also like a really interesting theme that we haven't quite talked about in this whole theme around understanding the impact of not necessarily narrative, but like incomplete information. And that's like, how do you look at underlying leading metrics that might ultimately correlate with the more results-based metric? And so, when I'm thinking about that, if you go back to like this idea, the first question that people ask about the driveline baseball thing, like if this, we know one of the things driveline does is increase your velocity. So if you start seeing consistently in the first couple starts of a new pitcher that his velocity is up, right? You could say like, okay, we'll drive. And then you say, oh, he went to driveline. And then you could probably look a little bit about the history of those driveline pitchers and maybe use that increase in velocity to better or update what your projections looked like on this player and give them sort of like a manual adjust.
Well, in essence, what I could do is basically try to figure out how much that added velocity, if he had it last year, would have what impact it would have on his stats, what the predicted impact. And then I would actually go and make that adjustment to those stats for predictive purposes, not, in my database, be like, okay, we're going to, he might've been a 4.7 ERA guy or something, just putting it in one simple statistics terms, but now, 2 miles an hour of velocity would be predicted to get him down to like a 4.49 ERA or something like that, right? And so then I could still keep it sort of my same model approach. I would just be making sort of adjustments to his past data to reflect what I think, how I think he would have performed. Did he have the sort of same physical conditioning basically as he does now? But Jeff, a long time ago when I was betting baseball, I used a velocity and starts like the last few starts as a way to try to detect injuries before or fatigue for guys before they went on the disabled list, when it was called the disabled list, or before their performance really suffered. Because I think the key is you want to get there first. That's where the alpha is. And to bring this back to golf, I mean, we know that how players perform in majors does have an impact. We know that how players play, for example, at Augusta National, like their course history has an impact, a predictive impact. But if you have some guy that hasn't played in a lot of majors yet or hasn't played at Augusta before, like aside from like the course fit stuff, you can use that. But if you can figure out the kind of thing, the things that will predict a guy overperforming there or overperforming in majors, that's a huge advantage. Like we can say that Brooks Koepka is really good in majors, but if we can identify the next Brooks Koepka before he actually does really well, overperforms in majors, I mean, there's a ton of value to that.
Yeah. Okay. One last question before we bring in Jordan. Weather. I know weather is a big thing that you're interested in because of the impact, the, you know, enormous impact it has. And I remember we did almost an entire episode on weather in college football games this past year, or at least there was a lot of talk around wind, and we know wind and the impact in football, and obviously wind and the impact in golf. Where obviously that's an interesting area for you. Like, where do you see the real opportunities there? Like, someone asked about dynamic versus static. I mean, I think what they're saying is, do you just kind of like model it out and just like let it go? What's that?
Weather is always dynamic.
Life is dynamic.
I didn't really understand the whole what they meant by dynamic weather in that particular question. Do you want to read the tweet? It's from Bitcoin Rhino at Rhino Vesting. Have you figured out modeling dynamic weather for golf events? Thoughts on Haralabas' recent tweets regarding limits, advertising, and gambling. However, you guys talked about that last podcast without me, so I won't even get into that. But
yeah, we did.
I mean, I don't understand what the tweeter, what Mr. Rhino means by dynamic weather. What the difference between that would
mean. Well, let's assume that what he means, and let's just take it to the broader perspective of just modeling weather. How far do you think you are to solving that? Let's say 100% is like, you know, like where are you in that journey? Because I'm assuming you're pretty low in that journey, right?
Well, of course I'm low on the journey, but I'm not a meteorologist. I think I'm pretty high relatively high given the information I have, the data I have at my disposal.
Okay, how about I say it to you? Okay, Rufus, I believe weather is the most important thing in all of your sports betting stuff. Over the next year, with unlimited resources and all the time in the world, what are you going to do to actually like get close to 100% in predicting weather?
What would I do?
Yeah.
I would get the best data I possibly could from historical weather data to be able to merge it onto historical performance stuff. I mean, I have a lot of that, but I would like more, and I would like more clearly. And so there's two pieces of it, right? There's the so that helps with quantifying the actual impact, the impact of actual weather on performance, which across any sport, right? So college football, you know, you have crosswind versus head to tailwind, whatever you're going to call it, baseball, et cetera. But then there's the part of forecasting it ahead of time. And I think that's the harder part. And being able to have an idea of if they were forecasted to be, let's say in a golf tournament, 5-mile-an-hour winds in the morning, picking up to 12 miles an hour in the afternoon. If the wind ends up being 10 miles an hour in the morning, is it going to be 17 miles an hour in the afternoon? Or how much is that going to affect that. So
Rufus, you have unlimited resources, right? So wouldn't the first thing you do be to go put like some kind of sensors at all the places that you want to take measurements for and just like collect data over the next year or whatever? And you know, then start, because that will help you get better forecasts and more accurate forecasts for what you ultimately want to forecast.
No, that's going to help me quantify. Like, that's going to help me quantify, not forecast.
Sure, but ultimately it'll help you forecast, yes, because you'll have better data.
It'll help me forecast, right, the impact of weather on performance. But I'm talking about actually forecasting the weather too and the dependencies within a forecast. Like, I think that's
the
hardest
piece to get. But we're not meteorologists. Maybe we should ask Ken Palm.
I think the hard part is figuring out the uncertainty around a weather forecast. Because you have a weather forecast, you know, I know it says, you know, I can see my hourly weather with the wind, temperature and the rain and all that stuff. And we know with rain, like, they actually add some, there's some uncertainty there. But with the wind, they don't say, okay, 2 miles an hour, but there's a chance it could be, you know, 1 mile an hour and chance it could be 6 miles an hour. And so for me, like, think about golf. What the value comes in betting on a golfer that is playing in more favorable conditions, which means less wind, generally speaking.
Fewer wind.
So let's say that there's an example where the weather, the wind is supposed to be light in the morning, picking up to heavy in the afternoon. That's the forecast. However, I don't know. What I care about is the difference between the morning and the afternoon. And maybe the uncertainty is just in the magnitude of the wind, but that same pattern is going to exist regardless, that the wind will pick up from the morning to the afternoon. But maybe, or maybe the uncertainty is in, will it pick up, right? So being able to understand that, I think, is sort of, would help me be able to sort of forecast the error bars in the weather impact. Because I can say, okay, this is the impact, you know, of playing at 3 miles an hour in 80 degree temperatures versus 12 miles an hour and 70 degrees or something like that. But being able to know how, what the sort of error bar is around that weather forecast and how a difference from the forecast affects the difference in a forecast, or the error, I guess, in a forecast later in the day. So, because ultimately I don't care about, I mean, I do care a little bit about the weather because absolute weather has an impact, but I care more about the relative differences in weather that players face.
Got it.
And so it comes less from forecasting the mean and more from forecasting the distribution. That's
interesting. But we literally just did talk about the weather for 5 minutes. So,
hey, we didn't talk about my golf game. So that's good.
Yeah. Or golf stories. All right, we'll leave that for next week. We're going to bring in Jordan Majewski and talk a little Final Four matchups. And then we'll be done with that. And we'll see you guys all next week. So welcome
to Bet the Process Calcutta, hopefully.
There you go. For the Masters.
We now welcome in Jordan Majewski to the Bet the Process podcast and what has become an annual tradition, where Jordan does such a great job with the Sweet 16 matchups that we need to have him back on for the Final Four. So, Jordan, what stood out to you most in the Sweet 16 of something that surprised you, and maybe something that did not surprise you at all?
Yeah, I think that kind of Duke's offensive game plan against NC State was a little surprising, and that they didn't really, you know, get Burns involved in pick and roll defense as much as I thought they would. And just their guard play and decision-making from their guards was not good enough to exploit just very exploitable issues within the NC State defense. So that was surprising to see. You know, I thought
Do you think they took them too lightly?
You know, if you watched Filipowski, his defense on Burns was evidence of someone taking him too lightly, which is surprising given that Burns had put up such big numbers on them in one game prior. But, you know, his effort defensively was about as embarrassing as I've seen in that magnitude of a game from that caliber of player. You know, I think there's a kind of viral tweet going around of a mashup of his contests and things like that against Burns, and it was, you know, not great. It was a pretty embarrassing effort. So that was surprising in that regard, and could speak to, you know, kind of not being prepared or taking them lightly in some regard.
Do you think there's a world where he was basically like, I just can't get into foul trouble, and then he ended up getting into foul trouble and very, you know, suspect calls? I feel like, I'm not a Duke apologist, but I feel like some of the calls against him were pretty tough, and he just kind of got in his own head at some
point. No, absolutely. I think a lot of the Duke guys were reacting poorly to the whistle. And I agree with you. A lot of those calls specifically on Flip were, you know, dubious at best. And you could see, you know, Proctor, Filipowski, they were clearly frustrated and just compounding mistakes based on that, based on the whistle. And yeah, kind of had, I'd noted it at the time, they had a mental and physical breakdown on the court, you know, and NC State clearly capitalized on that.
What do you think the most predictable thing was? And I have to say, like, I have a couple candidates that you said, you know, you talked a little bit about Illinois being a tough matchup for Iowa State because their ability to play five out and kind of really, you know, somewhat nullifying that Iowa State defense. And then also you talked about, you know, you very much made it sound like Duke would beat Houston just with the elite shot makers and the shots that they would end up getting. If they were, you know, able to sort of withstand the ball pressure and whatnot, and both of those things definitely rang true. Was there something to you that you thought, God, you know, this was very predictable?
Yeah, you know, Duke obviously benefited from Jamal Shedd getting hurt in the first half, and that, you know, Houston's already kind of a suspect offense in terms of who they can turn to for actually making shots. So taking Shedd away was really, you know, about as important of a player as you can remove from a roster. But, you know, yeah, Duke was able to hit the shots when it mattered, especially Filipowski. And it was, which made his performance against NC State even more surprising because he was so engaged and physical against Houston and matched their physicality, which was the big question with Filipowski, right? Like, can he, you know, bang basically? And he did. And maybe that was part of the problem against NC State. You know, I wish I had done a little more research on teams, how they perform after playing Houston, because that's always such a physical game, and whether, you know, you can get up for that, match that level of physicality. And they clearly did not against NC State the very next game. So, you know, that was kind of not mentioned in terms of Duke's poor performance in that regard. But, you know, it's also just, the mental mistakes from Duke. So, you know, that was predictable for me that Duke played so well against Houston, that they had that opportunity, that personnel, and then to see that performance against NC State was the opposite end of that spectrum in terms of what I thought would happen when they played NC State.
So let's go to Alabama, which is maybe one of the teams that, you know, you mentioned, I think, Grant Nelson was listening to the podcast and got very motivated by your calling out his defense. And he actually played a little bit of defense at the end of that, you know, at the end of that North Carolina game, and certainly stepped up incredibly offensively. Do you think that they have the best chance to upset UConn because of the amount of variance that they can create with their 3-point shots? And is their defense, you know, in a game where it's basically just going to be, can they get up enough threes and make enough threes to win that game? Is there a chance there? Or I guess what have you seen in Alabama over these last two games? Is there anything that gives you hope against UConn?
Yeah, I think in terms of a team that can give UConn a non-traditional fight, it's Alabama. And, you know, the idea of, so Alabama, of course, is a rim and three offense. They're the original, you know, math ball. We only take shots at the rim. We only take shots at, from three. I think their season high for mid-range shots in a game was 6 against Mizzou, who basically put all 5 guys in the paint in that game. But the idea of challenging Klingon by Underwood in Illinois you know, there's the famous clip now of him saying, if he blocks us 100 times, he blocks us 100 times, right? And then, like, they literally did not score against him at the rim. So, you know, I think I kind of get what Underwood was saying there. Like, you got to establish the run, so to speak, right? You know, you can't just chuck up three after three after three without any threat of attacking the rim. But, you know, I think Oates got the picture loud and clear there. And, you know, we have a pretty good test case with them against an elite drop coverage with a huge monster in the middle when they played Purdue and shot nearly 50 threes and hit 19 of them in that game in Toronto. And, you know, I think that's basically going to be the game plan again. Go scorched earth, put out your five most spread offense. You know, we saw Stevenson hit all those corner threes against Clemson. I think, you know, you just already your rim defense is poor. Just punt it entirely, spread the court with five shooters, and just chuck up as many threes as you can. You know, and they're going in, you're going to stay in the game like they did against Purdue, where they had a second half lead. Or you're going to, if you miss them, you're going to lead to a bunch of UConn transition runouts and you might get a 30-0 run put on you, which is what happened to Illinois. Their spread shooters, Guerrier and Hawkins, went like 2 for 11 from three in that game, you know? And if Stevenson and Nelson go 2 for 11 or probably more, you know, attempts, like if they go 5 for 20 or whatever, then they're going to get run off the court in transition off those long misses. So, you know, there's, like you said, there's the variance factor that Alabama is going to bring to the table. If they're hitting the shots, they can do it. You know, Caravan is their most attack, the guy that you can attack the most on defense with them. And Nelson will be able to attack him. So you're going to get some non-traditional shrink threes, as Nate Oates likes to call them, where you're going to get off Nelson's penetration rather than Sears, who's going to be, you know, guarded by Castle, who did a great job on Shannon in the Elite Eight. So they have a non-traditional shooter's chance against UConn. And I don't think anyone else could necessarily offer that perspective in terms of matchups.
It's almost like you want to bet from a betting perspective, you almost bet an alternate line on UConn and the money line on Alabama if you're going to bet one side or the other.
That is exactly my plan.
Just because of the high amount of it.
Yeah.
Is that what your plan is?
Yeah, that was like to a T. That was what I'm outlining.
All right, let's move on to the Purdue NC State game. I was watching that game and just feeling in the NC State game, like, please, I really just don't want to see DJ Burns versus Edie. And I didn't want to see it, that idea of just, and then I started thinking about it. And I'm like, maybe I do want to see that. Maybe there's some surprise here for me. So, you know, what is there a reason that does NC State have a chance here? I just don't see it, I guess.
Yeah, they're going to run a lot of the same offense that Tennessee did against Purdue in terms of, well, not excluding Burns. Burns is his own separate thing, but in terms of the way they run a bunch of pin downs and like kind of shrink the floor in the middle of the court, which is how you can beat Purdue. They have a tough time navigating those pin downs and like secondary actions in the middle of the floor because they kind of don't know what to do with Edie defending off the ball. And he kind of gets lost, and Purdue as a team kind of gets lost navigating those screens. And NC State has been really good this tournament and the ACC tournament at exploiting drop coverage in that way. They don't just like attack drop coverage with dribble penetration. They've actually, like, you know, they move Horn around, and then it helps that O'Connell's been hitting jump shots as well. And then in terms of the Burns question, this comes down to a person who's on the court issue. Because if you can kind of cross match with Edie and Burns in terms of their defensive matchups. So I don't necessarily think we're going to see Edie on Burns a lot. I think Trey Kaufman-Wren's going to get that assignment. And the way that Painter has been using Edie a lot down the stretch, it's kind of like this soft no middle where he kind of shades behind Trey Kaufman-Wren as the primary post defender. And then like brings like kind of this soft double and just affects the play with his size. And he's really good at cutting off that baseline on that soft double. And we all know Burns likes to spin baseline, go over his right shoulder. So I think that's going to be the game plan where Trey Kaufman-Wren is the primary defender. He's got really good mobility, agility, like side to side movement against Burns. He's got that big wide base. And so I think that'll be the issue. So the issue then is, can Purdue's best way to exploit NC State's defense is to have Mason Gillis at the four and not Trey Kaufman Wren. Because when Kaufman Wren is on the floor, then that allows NC State to cross match with Burns against him and kind of hide Burns's defense against Kaufman Wren. So, but then Gillis, when he comes in, offers a floor stretching thing, and you put Diarra in a bad spot in terms of his help and recovery, which is great. He's been a great defender. He's changed the way NC State plays defense overall, but he's going to have to get out on the perimeter. Whereas with Trey Kaufman Wren, you don't. So it's kind of who Painter can keep on the floor at the four in terms of NC State being able to stay in this game, I think.
It's interesting. It seems like you, from that analysis, it sounds like both teams will be able to score. And if NC State can get Purdue into like secondary actions and scrambling a little bit, they're going to be able to score. I don't know. I'm kind of going to like think about this, like, do they have a chance? But it sounds like you believe that there is a chance here, because there is a style that, you know, Tennessee was able to score against Purdue some and had some success there, and right. Maybe and NC State can also.
And they run a lot of the same actions. And, you know, the interesting thing with NC State's defense, too, is that Keats has long been presses a lot. He's got, you know, traditionally one of the highest press rates in the country. That's gone by the wayside in this, you know, miraculous run they've had, mostly out of the sheer amount of games they've had to play, you know, this month. So, you know, Purdue's undefeated when they have a turnover rate less than 20%, 29-0. They're 4-4 when their turnover rate goes over 20%. So that's clearly the path, you know, be physical with Braden Smith, be physical with Lawyer. You know, they've improved in that regard, but it's still the way forward against them, to kind of push them off their spots, make them uncomfortable on offense. And it'll be interesting to see if Keats kind of goes back to that. He's, you know, almost completely dropped that in terms of full court pressure and up the line pressure. So, you know, with the amount of rest they've had and, you know, time to scout and game plan and things like that, it's something that we could potentially see in terms of, you know, pushing Purdue's guards around a little bit.
NC State's, you know, obviously this story of, you know, coming in and surprising and, you know, whatever, but their team is all pretty old, right? And they are like transfers and whatnot. What is their actual talent level? Because, you know, obviously if you didn't follow college basketball, you would have said, oh, these guys are an upstart surprise. But my guess is that not true?
Yeah. You know, I think you can make the case that a lot of those guys like Horn, O'Connell, you know, they took some time, Diarra, to get acclimated or whatever you want to Keats's system or whatever. You know, I think a lot of it's just luck as well. But like I said, they have made some like definite schematic changes. Like they're switching 1 through 4 up top against versus, you know, so dropping Burns, but they've done way more switching. O'Connell's defense has been just textbook in almost every regard in every game through the ACC tournament. And, you know, Castle's defense for UConn gets a lot of love in terms of lockdown perimeter defenders, but O'Connell's been right up there. He's been incredible. And then, like, you know, they can kind of shift personnel. And the thing is, they can win without Burns. And when they go to Middlebrooks, he's a much better pick and roll defender at the five. And it will be, you know, another example of the personnel on the floor and who's forced into what personnel packages in this game. Because, you know, obviously you lose just an incredible amount of offense with Middlebrooks, but you also become better defensively, especially in pick and roll defense. And Purdue has turned, they're a lot like UConn, you know, they have a lot of great motion sets, a lot of great secondary actions, which is kind of what Painter's known for. But Braden Smith has become just an elite ball screen operator, and they run more pick and roll than they ever have. Like they were just killing Tennessee with their Spain pick and roll. And then obviously Edie in the post was the big issue, but he was also just dominating Tennessee's pick and roll defense. Smith was just completely manipulating them in that regard. So it's not just that Purdue, you know, feeds Edie all the time on the block. It's far from that. And it's going to be tough for, I think, NC State to consistently trade offense, defense, defense, offense throughout the course of that game in terms of stopping Purdue's offense.
Is Middlebrooks going to make it to the game? Has he left Flip's head yet? Because I feel like he was directly living in Flip's head that game.
Yeah. He's great in that regard, too. You know, I don't think that's going to happen against Purdue's guys. But, yeah, that's he definitely changes the game in terms of his physicality.
All right. So last thing, assuming we get UConn Purdue, what's that line and what are Purdue's chances to win that game? What do they need to do to win that game? I guess we should say.
Yeah. You know, I think Purdue, it would be what, UConn 4.5 or something like that. Probably maybe more, but it would be obviously the matchup everyone wants to see, you know, Klingon versus Edie. That would be, it kind of feels like that's what this whole season's been leading up to, UConn versus Purdue. And I'm desperate to see it, you know. Like, I would love to see Edie get challenged by someone. You know, Klingon has allowed, I think, 0.25 points per possession as a post defender this year, which is, you know, incredible. Teams don't really challenge him in the post that often. But, you know, this would be the one time someone has a legitimate chance to defend Edie one-on-one in the post. And I think that's what we all want to see. But, you know, it'll probably come down to kind of secondary or even tertiary guys like Mason Gillis hitting 4 threes or something like that, 5 threes for Purdue to actually have a chance at that. Because, you know, you got to attack Spencer, you got to attack Caravan, and those are kind of not where Purdue's the strongest offensively.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you, Jordan. As always, we'll probably talk to you again next year. Maybe we'll do a check-in in the middle of the year just so our listeners have some knowledge of college basketball going into the tournament. But we
absolutely
appreciate the time.
Love being on. Thanks for having me back. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line is watered down. It seems like they don't get it. Puppeteers are but the engines running off unleaded. None of it's organic. It all sounds synthetic. That's why I fucks with Jeff Ma and his dog Rufus. No locks of the year. They just tell you what their truth is. Maybe make your pockets fatter as the bookies get thinner. Give the information, turn and losing betters into winners. Yeah, Sturm Herm, reppin' Rutgers, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, crunching all the numbers, Massey Peabody rankings, we're looking for the edge, analytically driven, crunching all the numbers.